Well, I do welcome you to our next to the last evening session, apart from the exam. It's good to see the faithful still returning after, lo, these many weeks. I know it's tough to get out in the evening, but it's good to see you here. We want to begin by committing this time to the Lord in prayer, and I think it wouldn't be inappropriate that we remember Dr. Calhoun in particular, though that is a time reference that will perhaps not be as meaningful in the future. We do want to continue to pray for him. He had some tests done today. So let's begin with prayer. Our Father God, we thank you that you are a sovereign Lord, not only over history, but over our very lives. And we thank you that even as we have just mentioned Dr. David Calhoun, we know that you are sovereignly overseeing his condition as he fights cancer. We pray, Father, that you would buoy him up by your Spirit, and that according to your will, you would restore him to health. We ask, Lord, that you would bring back a good report from the tests that he is that he has received today. But, Lord, we submit our wills and our human desires to your greater wisdom. And we ask that in all things you be honored and glorified. Lord, I pray now that you would be with us even as we continue to search your word. I pray that you would give us hearts of wisdom, but more than that, that you would give us hearts that desire to be full toward you, perfect hearts, which can only be your doing. Father, I pray that you would seek and find those little time bombs that may be ticking away in our lives, and that you would defuse them and put us on the right path. For we cannot guard ourselves, but we trust you to guard us. Father, help us now as we continue to work in the book of Kings. We ask that you would be here to illumine our minds and to inspire and to bend our wills to yours. For we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, as duly threatened last time, I will finish in short order right at the beginning talking about Solomon. We almost made it in our last session, but not quite. So I want to say a few more things about Solomon. And on your outline, which you received last time, now you should also have received a fairly hefty outline for later this evening, there on the back tables as you walk in. But on your outline, which you received last time, we are at the point in the outline which is entitled Solomon Takes, 1 Kings 10. So you may want also to open your Bibles to 1 Kings 10. So that we can highlight some things as we work through. If you remember at the front of this set of outlines that you received last time, I gave you 1 Kings 1 to 11 in overview and sought to present it in terms of a kind of a simple, even simplistic chiasm. So you may want to look back at that overview from time to time to see why it is that I choose such a weird title as Solomon Takes. It's meant to parallel the earlier section, chapter 2, where he takes charge, where he received his charge from David, and then really began to take charge of his own affairs. And now as we come to chapter 10, after two appearances of the Lord to Solomon in chapters 3 and 9, and then a central section in which Solomon built the temple, we come now to see how Solomon responded to the second appearance of the Lord to him. And remember last time also we noticed that God found it necessary to appear to Solomon at his high point in chapter 9, when he had really reached the pinnacle of his career, if we can speak of a royal reign as a career. But he had earlier appeared to him at his low point. So be it our lowest point or our highest point, we really need to see God afresh, to have a vision of God so that we continue to think theologically in our lives. Well, Solomon was warned in this second appearance that things could go wrong, that he needed to be very careful. If you and your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them. Just at the pinnacle of Solomon's career, he needed to hear a warning. And we looked in chapter 9, beginning in verse 10, we look for Solomon's response. You know, what does Solomon do having heard this warning? Well, unfortunately, we noted last time, he doesn't seem to respond much at all. At least, nothing is recorded by way of a prayer or a response or a plea that God would keep him true, we simply hear nothing of Solomon's response to this second appearance of the Lord. And so then as we move on into chapter 9, into the remainder of chapter 9, we find that Solomon is taking. He was given much, but somehow he still found it necessary to take. And we talked about some of this last time, so I won't reiterate it all. But we do see him taking such things as quantities of gold, chariots, even sending off to Egypt to bring back these chariots. And then when we come to chapter 11, we will discover that he is also taking many wives. And this cannot help but recall Deuteronomy 17, where the king in Israel was told that he should not accumulate silver and gold, he should not accumulate horses, which would imply also chariots, and certainly he should not go back to Egypt for them, and he should not accumulate wives. Three strikes and you're out. And we see that Solomon is on his way now to being removed from kingship. He was not rejected as Saul had been, because God had promised to David in 2 Samuel 7, I will not, when your son sins, I will chastise him with the rod of men, but I will not reject him. I will not sweep him away as I swept away Saul who was before you. God's gracious purpose for the line of David continues, but Solomon will suffer at least in anticipation of the division of the kingdom. God is quite gracious, as we'll see in just a minute, even in his administration of discipline to Solomon. So then, as we come to chapter 10, we find Solomon on the take, and we have recorded in chapter 10 the visit of the Queen of Sheba, who is simply amazed at what she finds in Solomon's court. It takes her breath away. And she reports to the king that the report I heard in my own country, this is verse 6, the report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true, but I did not believe these things until I came and saw with my own eyes. Well, what was it that she had seen? Verse 4, she saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord. She was overwhelmed with what she saw. Solomon has been amassing very impressive things and gathering them more or less around himself. Now, this is a reminder of something we also noted earlier, that blessings, God's blessings, can become snares. Remember, God had said to Solomon, because of his unselfish request in chapter 3, that he would give him not only what he asked for, which was wisdom and discerning, a discerning mind or discerning heart, but also riches and honor, which he had not asked for. And so riches and honor were gifts of God to Solomon. It was appropriate that he receive them. But it seemed that he began then to desire more even than what God was giving. And so he went out after the riches and sought to surround himself with a court that would be impressive, that would bring honor. A slight imbalance in our lives, beginning to emphasize even God's blessings in the wrong way, can ultimately put us off balance and bring about our downfall. And that's what we begin to hear about as we get into chapter 11. In chapter 11, we read of Solomon's great loss, again paralleling his great gain in chapter 1, where he had received the kingdom. Now in chapter 11, we see that the kingdom is at least proleptically taken from him. I say proleptically because it doesn't actually happen in Solomon's lifetime. It happens in the lifetime of his son. And we'll see that as we work through a little bit of chapter 11. So first of all, let's look on your outline at the covenant-breaking king and see what chapter 11 says about Solomon's offenses. Now, this comes against the background of his accumulation of gold, his accumulation of chariots. And then in chapter 11, in the first three verses, we read this. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth, and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. Now, several things here in these first few verses which speak of Solomon's forbidden affections. He began to set his heart on things that were in fact forbidden. Several of these things remind us of chapter 3. One is the use of the word love. He loved many foreign wives. The only other time Solomon is said to love something is back in chapter 3 when it was recorded that Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of David, or as we retranslated that last time, Solomon loved the Lord enough to walk according to the statutes of his father David. He loved the Lord to a degree sufficient to follow David's commands. Now, David had asked him to, had charged him to walk according to the statutes of Moses, but at least he was making an attempt to obey his father in these matters. But there seems to be a limit to Solomon's love. And here again in chapter 11, we see that his love is now turned in other directions. Solomon loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Remember also how back in chapter 3 we read that very simple notice that kind of comes out of the blue. Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter in verse 1, chapter 3. And we read that and we don't, not much is made of it, and we wonder, why do we need to know that here? Well, I think it's, again, to reinforce what we looked at when last we met. The narrator intentionally introduces aspects of Solomon's life and his choices in such a way that we almost miss them. They're simply slipped in. He doesn't make anything of them. He doesn't comment upon them at the time. There's no commentary, no moral drawn. They're just mentioned, and then the narrative moves on. And I think the strategy of the narrator there is to enable us to experience in our reading of Solomon's life what life is like as these little choices, which seem so insignificant at the time, eventually begin to bear fruit, be they good fruit or bad fruit. And so here at chapter 11, when Solomon is about to be counted out, three strikes and you're out, we have this recollection, this recalling of chapter 3. He loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. So we see in the first three verses of chapter 11 that Solomon, a covenant-breaking king, is beginning to go after forbidden affections. He's setting his heart on things that were forbidden. We see then, as we move on into to verses 4 to 6, that these forbidden affections led to fractured allegiances. And you'll see that I'm straining very valiantly to make all these things sound the same. But the forbidden affections lead to fractured allegiances in verses 4 to 6. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. Remember, he had a discerning heart. He had a wise heart. He was smart. But that's a far cry from being fully devoted to the Lord. No one could probably have matched him in terms of native wit. But in terms of devotion to God, he fell far short of his own father, David. Verse 5, he followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David, his father, had done. So forbidden affections lead to these fractured allegiances. He is now impaired. He's not following the Lord wholly, fully, as David his father had done. And these in turn lead to foolish actions. Verses 7 and 8. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their god, or to their gods. Now, when you picture this, it's astonishing. Think about it. Solomon is the individual whom God used for the building of his temple in Jerusalem. And having created that magnificent structure to the true God, because of these other little sins in his life, disobeying God with regard to marrying foreign wives. Now again, it's not an ethnic thing. It's not a matter of foreigners per se. It's a matter of those who worship other gods. It's a religious separation that was required of a king in Israel. But by ignoring those commands, Solomon finds himself in a position of now being led astray, so that having built this wonderful temple, he's establishing these little shrines to false gods all around the temple. It's amazing. It's as if, you know, one of the local churches built a magnificent structure for the worship of the true God, and then for one reason or another began to erect little cult centers or New Age tarot card reading centers around in the parking lot. And we think that's ridiculous. It is a ridiculous picture, but that's how, you know, setting our affection on the wrong things, that which is forbidden, leads to fractured allegiances and foolish actions. And we look at Solomon and we think, Solomon, that's ridiculous. How could you do that? But now I want us to think a little bit about our own lives. Do we ever do that? You know, we in a sense have a place of worship where we worship God and perhaps times of worshiping God. But do we sometimes then seek to establish, maybe just for safety's sake or to hedge our bets, other little shrines to gods that are no gods? Now, most of us don't have idols in this new age in which we live. Some people do have little idols sitting on their mantles. But most of us don't worship idols of wood and stone. But we do have other idols that attract our attention and in whom we put our trust or in which we put our trust. And I think we need to, you know, think about our lives even as we contemplate the foolishness of what Solomon did and how ridiculous that picture looked. And I think, you know, sometimes we look that ridiculous, maybe to our children, maybe to outsiders, maybe to those who are unbelievers, who say, you know, if I believed what you believed about God and thought that you know, a sovereign God was overseeing my circumstances, I wouldn't worry about a thing. So why are you worrying? And I love it when our children, when they're very young sometimes, they get right to the point and say, but, you know, aren't we just supposed to trust God about that? You know, when we're getting all worried about something and, oh yeah, you know, out of the mouths of babes. So think about that, you know, in terms of your own life. Don't just think, you know, how stupid Solomon was. Think, am I being stupid? You know, number one, am I allowing these little time bombs to be ticking away? It's up to God to find them, but it's up to us to pray that He will find them and diffuse them. But also ask, am I erecting these little shrines around me? Or am I keeping my worship of God pure? Now, in contrast to the covenant-breaking king, we also read in this very chapter about a covenant-keeping God. We read about his response to what Solomon has done. The first thing we hear about in verses 9 to 10 is divine displeasure. God is not pleased. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. Notice how the narrator now begins to remind us of these things and to comment upon the two appearances of God. He begins to bring these things back to mind and say, God had a right to be angry because he appeared to Solomon when he most needed him, when he felt like a little child. He provided what he asked for and more to boot, all those things he didn't ask for. God also did not leave him without warning. Sometimes people make something of the fact that King Solomon is a king without a prophet. You don't really hear about a Nathan in the life of Solomon. But God himself appeared to Solomon to warn him. And if God himself appears, then perhaps Nathan is not so necessary. God warned him at the pinnacle of his career that things could still go awry. And yet, Solomon ignored these warnings, apparently, and the Lord was angry. I think we underestimate our God if we think nothing we do ever makes him angry, any more than nothing my children might do would ever make me angry. Now, nothing jeopardizes my love for them, and nothing jeopardizes God's love for us if we are His, but we can make Him angry and experience His divine displeasure. And this leads then to divine discipline in verse 11. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Solomon's sin has consequences. Now notice he doesn't say, I am rejecting you from being king. He doesn't even say, I am rejecting you from being my child. It's not that kind of discipline, but there is a consequence to Solomon's long-term sin. And again, I think, though we emphasize grace, and rightly so, it's grace that makes us God's children. We didn't earn it, we don't merit it, we don't keep it, we don't have to strive to stay His children. I do think we need to recognize that sometimes a God who loves us unconditionally will administer that love in differing ways for our good. And if we misbehave, if we fall into sin, it is for our good that He discipline us. So never think that sin doesn't have its consequences. We don't bear the punishment for our sins. Jesus did that. But divine displeasure gives way to divine discipline. And it's good for us when God disciplines us, just as it's good for our children when we care enough to dare to discipline, if I can put in a little plug for that book. Then, finally, however, we and here I'm really stretching to keep the DDs going, we note a divine determination to express grace even in this situation. Look at verses 12 and 13. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it, that is, tear the kingdom away from you. I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. God promises in various places in the books of Kings, and we'll see some of these later, to keep a lamp burning for David, a little lamp flickering for his servant David. The Davidic promise is still in force. Part of that Davidic promise, if you turn back to 2 Samuel 7, however, look at 2 Samuel 7, verse 14. Having in verse 13 made this astonishing promise, he is the one who will build a house for my name. This is directed at Solomon, this son, your offspring, who will come from your own body. In verse 12, this Solomon, he is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Then in verse 14, I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. So punish in that sense, not in a more severe sense, but in a disciplinary sense. I will punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. God has made a gracious promise to David that even the sin, this rather exorbitant, extravagant sin of Solomon, cannot negate. However, he has said, when he does wrong, I will punish him. I will afflict him with floggings, with the floggings of men. And that's exactly what we discover now as you move on in chapter 11. Notice what it says in beginning in verse 14. Then the Lord raised up against Solomon an adversary, Hadad the Edomite, from the royal line of Edom. Now this may seem like esoteric material of very little interest, but I want you to stick with me for a minute on this, because I think it's interesting that Hadad is the first of the adversaries to be raised up by the Lord against Solomon. Verse 15, earlier when David was fighting with Edom, Joab, the commander of the army who had gone up to bury the dead, had struck down all the men of Edom. Joab and all the Israelites stayed there for 6 months until they had destroyed all the men of Edom. But Hadad, still only a boy, fled to Egypt with some Edomite officials who had served his father. They set out from Midian and went to Paran. Then, taking men from Paran with them, they went to Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave Hadad a house and a land and provided him with food. Pharaoh was so pleased with Hadad that he gave him a sister of his own wife, Queen Tahpenes, in marriage. The sister of Tapenes bore him a son named Genubath, whom Tapenes brought up in the royal palace. Then Genubath lived with Pharaoh's own children. While he was in Egypt, Hadad heard that David rested with his fathers and that Joab, the commander of the army, was also dead. Then Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Let me go that I may return to my own country." What have you lacked here that you want to go back to your own country? Pharaoh asked. "Nothing," Hadad replied, "but do let me go." And he comes back and begins to hassle, to provide a threat, to afflict, to flog, as it were, Solomon. Now, why do you think this is an interesting notice? Anyone have an idea? Yes, William. Sorry? Yeah, in a sense, that's true. Right, in terms of marrying into the Pharaonic household. Okay, that's not actually what I was thinking about, although that's kind of interesting itself. Something maybe simpler than that. Yes? Okay. Right, okay. Yeah, I mean, Hadad had fled at an earlier point. All right, we're beginning to close in on what I think is particularly interesting about this. Yes? Yeah, is there a parallel to God bringing his people out of Egypt and now bringing Hadad out of Egypt? Maybe a very oblique one. That's not what I'm thinking of, but again, dissertations are built on far less than that. Anyone else have an idea? Think about what catalyzed Hadad's return. What was it that inspired him to return? David's death? Joab's death. Now, what do we make of that? David's death, Joab's death. How did these things come about? You remember chapter 2? Yes, Michael? I don't think so. The question is whether Hadad may have been associated with the lineage of Saul. I don't think so, but being Edomite. But just think in terms of what the narrative has told us about Joab meeting his end. At whose hand did he do that? Who had Joab killed? Solomon. Okay, and why did he have Joab killed? David told him to. He said, you know, you've got some difficult people in your kingdom. You're a man of wisdom. You'll know what to do. And sure enough, Solomon knew what to do. And back in chapter 2, remember we noted a little subtlety in the narrative back at that point, that in chapter 2, verse 12, before Solomon does anything, he's on the throne, and it says, and his rule was firmly established, very firmly established. Then he begins to take matters, he begins to act according to his wisdom, remember? And he eliminates various difficult people, including Joab, thinking thereby to more firmly establish his kingdom. And at the end of chapter 2, if I can retranslate again, it says, the kingdom was now established by Solomon's hand. God had firmly established him. Prior to Solomon lifting a hand, Solomon had then gone about using his mind, his human wisdom. He was a man of wisdom, as David acknowledged. He went about then trying to secure his position even more, little knowing that by bringing about the death of Joab, he was actually triggering the return of Hadad. You see the point? Okay, now it's a vast subtlety. I was not the first one to notice that. Someone actually in Sunday school pointed that out and said, hey, that's interesting. And I thought, that is interesting. I'll take that on board. Very often, when we go out and try to establish ourselves, you know, using our human wisdom, we don't know the full ramification of what we do. And what may look like a good idea on the face of it, if it's not of God, it in fact may end up working quite in the reverse, as we see here. And so I think there's a kind of a very nice irony in the fact that Hadad is the first to return, the first of those adversaries, and Solomon's own action in having Joab eliminated actually led to that. Well, Solomon at that point early in his career was acting according to his own wisdom. And in chapter 3, remember when God asked him, what can I do for you? He said, I'm just a little child. I don't know what I'm doing. And then God gave him divine wisdom. And thereafter, I think we have a playing back and forth in terms of the wisdom of Solomon between his own native ability and intelligence and a God-given, God-inspired wisdom. And sometimes Solomon's operating more out of the one and sometimes more out of the other. When we come to the end of chapter 11, he seems to be reverting back to that old human wisdom. He recognizes in Jeroboam, who is introduced in chapter 11, a threat, and he tries to have him killed. So the Solomon that began trying to eliminate difficult individuals ends his days at the same task, trying to eliminate those whom he regards as a threat. Now, let's pause there for just a minute and contemplate one other thing in terms of the grace of God. I do say that there is a divine determination here right at the end of the not the end of the chapter, but in verses 11 and following, or 12 and following, where it says, "Nevertheless, for the sake of David." I think that as we focus on the failings of the human characters, it's very important that we turn our gaze and then look at the faithfulness of God himself. Because God remains faithful to that promise to David, as difficult as it is in these circumstances, when Solomon has struck out three times, all three of those things that were forbidden in Deuteronomy 17, he has now extravagantly fulfilled and done. And yet God remains faithful and keeps that lamp burning for David. And this will become the story of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, particularly Judah, as we have good kings, or sort of good kings and not so good kings. And yet, amidst all the vicissitudes of human behavior, misbehavior, God's purpose, God's gracious purpose for the Davidic line continues to move forward. Now, ultimately, we'll come to the exile, the fall of the south, the exile in Babylon, no longer a Davidic king visibly on a throne, and yet even that does not terminate God's gracious purpose to raise up that Davidic king who will reign eternally. And so that very failure of the physical descendants of David during the kingship period, that very failure began to give rise to a messianic expectation that there would one day be a true anointed one who would fulfill these promises. And that's what we see then in the birth and life of Christ. Now, any comments or questions before we move on to another outline and another topic? Yes, sir. Okay, the question is a terribly knotty one. Where would we find the writing of the book of Ecclesiastes in here? Now, in a class earlier today, Psalms and Wisdom class, we were talking about the very issue of the authorship of Ecclesiastes. And if I can dare be so brief, it is not certain that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, if I can dare be so brief. I'll be a little bit more expansive than that. It is never explicitly claimed in the book that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. There are a number of reasons given by scholars, both of a liberal and a conservative persuasion. And since I'm being taped, I won't necessarily name all the names, but I could name some of the stellar conservative scholars around who do not hold to Solomonic authorship of the book of Ecclesiastes. One of the major possibilities, and I think this is a possibility, is that the writer of Ecclesiastes assumes Solomonic garb in the early chapters and thus makes a point from the life of Solomon about the meaninglessness of the pursuit of building projects and pleasures and prestige and power and all of those things in chapter 2, for instance. Now, having said that, that it's not certain that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, I'm probably something of a conservative throwback in that as I look at the arguments that would disallow the possibility that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, I'm not sure that they are compelling. So at this point, in the limitations of my current knowledge, I prefer to leave the door open to the possibility that Solomon did write the book of Ecclesiastes, but it is far from a certainty that he did. Okay. Now, one of the problems with it is precisely the question you ask. Where in this account, the story of the life of Solomon, do we find that? Well, nothing at all is said about his spending some of his latter days in reflection and perhaps remorse for the way he had lived his life. Although it's certainly possible that he did so, and it's just not recorded. Phew. Didn't expect that question. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? Yes. Yeah, the question is, in what sense is God's allowing Solomon, or at least his son, to remain in possession of a portion of the kingdom while taking away the 10 tribes? Is that a fulfillment of the promise earlier made to David in 2 Samuel 7? Or is it a way of saying, look, you've blown it, and that promise is no longer in play, but because I'm a gracious God, I'm going to do this other gracious thing for you? I think it's really the former. I think he's saying, look, I've made a promise, and that promise is rests on the eternal purposes of God. That promise will not be revoked. Now, the way in which that promise is experienced by succeeding generations is somewhat conditional on their behavior. One thing that my colleague Jack Collins says sometimes in regard to this particular issue, if I can remember how to quote, and I think he got this from John Murray, is that the Davidic promise is unconditional with respect to merit, but conditional with respect to instrumentality. Now, what that means, being interpreted, I think, is that each individual king, as you read the book of Kings, you see that kings were deposed, rejected, lost their lives, and so forth, by virtue of their own misbehavior, their own sin. And so God did deal with individual kings in terms of the way in which their own faithlessness and sin made it necessary for him to deal with them, and they bore the consequences of their sin. However, even their very failures were not sufficient to abrogate, to set aside the purposes of God. So amidst all that human failure and faithlessness, God manages to keep driving toward the fulfillment of his gracious purpose in ways that I don't think David could have even imagined. He was astonished when God spoke to him as he did. And he said, to what human being have you ever spoken this way before? He knew that something special was in view, but he wasn't sure, I think, what it was. Okay, any other comments or questions? All right, I think we have time to begin on the next outline, which is entitled at the top, The Kingdom Divided. We'll not get quite through this before we have to take a break, so we will take a break in a little while. But the kingdom divided, and unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, from your perspective, we won't have time just to march straight on through the book of 1 and 2 Kings in their entirety. But I do want to touch on a few more aspects tonight. We're going to look at the next few chapters, The Kingdom Divided. We're going to take a sample from the life of Elijah and talk about that. And either later tonight or perhaps a week from now, in a later session, we're going to talk about the two histories of Israel, talk about Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles together. But right now we want to look at the kingdom divided. This is what follows on immediately after what we've just been reading about. And this gets in then to the life of Rehoboam, the division of the kingdom, the establishment of Jeroboam as king of the north, and so forth and so on. And again, I have a little chiasm for you. Now, I really am not that attracted to chiasms. I don't always find these, but sometimes it's an easy way to kind of see what the focal point of a particular section is, and you do see a bit of a pattern that maybe helps you remember it. I'm not saying that these things were necessarily intentional in terms of the original writer, although some of them probably were. It's just hard to tell which ones might have been. Well, look first at the broad overview as you look at this outline. Notice that Rehoboam figures first in chapter 12, and in this first episode, he follows bad counsel, which leads to the division of the kingdom. Now, Rehoboam will appear again at the end of chapter 14, where his idolatry and his death are recorded. Now, inside these two elements which focus on Rehoboam, we have a major focus on Jeroboam, who received the 10 northern kingdoms and became king in the north. He too, in chapter 12, follows bad counsel and brings about a division of the worship. Rehoboam was responsible for the division of the kingdom. Jeroboam is responsible for a division of the worship of Israel as he set up those calves, those golden calves, to prevent Israel from going back down to Jerusalem. We'll talk all about that. And then in chapter 13, Jeroboam appears at the beginning of chapter 14 in the parallel section where his rejection and death are recorded. So we begin with Rehoboam followed by Jeroboam. We conclude with Jeroboam's death followed by Rehoboam's death. And in the middle, chapter 13, 1 Kings 13, is one of the strangest stories in the Bible. And it'd be interesting once we look at it to know how many of you have ever heard a sermon preached on 1 Kings 13. It's kind of a tough one to know exactly what to do with. So we're going to spend a little time looking at this. I'm attracted by strange things. Now, not in terms of my spouse or anything, but I'm attracted by strange passages in the Bible. And so we'll spend a little time trying to say, what does this mean? Why is this here? What does this very weird story mean? But first, let's kind of work into it by beginning with that first section. Rehoboam follows bad counsel. You know the situation. You know what God has said to Solomon. Now look at chapter 12, verses 6 and following. Perhaps I should preface this by simply saying that the men of Israel have come to Rehoboam and have made a request in verse 4. They say, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." And Rehoboam answered, perhaps wisely, "Go away for 3 days and then come back to me." He needed some time to think, to gather some information, to make a reasonable decision, it would be hoped. So the people went away. And then we come to verse 6. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. "How would you advise me to answer these people?" he asked. They replied, "If you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants." But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving with him and were serving him. He asked them, "What is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, 'Lighten the yoke your father put on us'?" The young men who had grown up with him replied, "Tell these people who have said to you, 'Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter,' tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist.'" In other words, you haven't seen anything yet. "My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." And Rehoboam chose to follow this advice. Now, I don't know if we can infer things about the wisdom of age, and it's better to listen to your elders and don't listen to your younger peers and so forth, and people who think just like you. But nevertheless, it's clear that Rehoboam follows some very bad advice. A principle of leadership, I think, is that leadership that involves, first and foremost, service. That is, people are quite happy to follow leaders who seem to have their good at heart. I think one of the beauties of, I shouldn't mention corporate names and such, but there are certain corporations that really try to develop their people, and as their people are developed, then the business is developed. As they serve the needs of those in their employ, then in fact the business often does far better than if they are using people and loving profits. You know, they love the people and they reap the profits very often. Well, Rehoboam nevertheless chose to follow the younger advisors. Maybe that's the heatedness of age. It sounded more exciting to come back with a harsh answer. You've got to establish yourself right early. Rehoboam wants to fight, and he does initiate a fight. In fact, the people rebel, and they say in verse 16, "What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel, look after your own house, O David." And so the Israelites went home. He precipitated his own rebellion in that sense by his harsh answer. And when Rehoboam recognizes that he is then under threat, then he wants to take action. But Shemaiah, the man of God, in verse 22 comes and says says to him that he shouldn't do so because this is of the Lord. The Lord is working out his purposes. And so Rehoboam takes that and goes home. Well, then we come in verse 25 to Jeroboam, who also is found to be following bad counsel. Verse 25, "Then Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. From there he went out and built up Peniel. Jeroboam thought to himself, 'The kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to the king. after seeking advice, okay, the same term that was used earlier of Rehoboam, where it was translated, then King Rehoboam consulted the elders. It doesn't sound exactly the same in English, but it is. After seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, It is too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Doesn't that sound rather strange? Sounds a bit like Aaron at the time that those first golden calves were made. And there may be an intentional patterning of the telling of this story to draw our attention to that earlier event. One he set up in Bethel, the other in Dan, and this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. So in verses 26 and 27, we see that Jeroboam, as others before him, began to think in untheological ways. In other words, he began to discount God, God's power, and God's presence, and indeed God's promise to him. In verse 26, Jeroboam thought to himself. Where have we heard that kind of phrase before? One that comes to my mind is in way back in 1 Samuel 27, after experiencing the Lord's deliverance in the Nabal episode and so forth and so on, but David thought to himself, one of these days I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. You know how hard it is for people to trust what God has promised. They just tend to forget it, begin to think in non-theological ways. And again, the challenge for us, I think, is to be theological in all our thinking, in all our decision-making. Put God center stage and take Him seriously. Believe that He's a reality and act accordingly. Put yourselves in positions where if He's not a reality, you're bound to fail. And that, by that, you will learn that He is, in fact, a reality, and your faith will be built. Jeroboam was not thinking that way. He was concerned for pragmatic things that the people would soon begin going back to Jerusalem. And so he seeks advice, as Rehoboam had done, in this case, bad advice. And he builds the golden calves. And then he gives the rationale in verses 28 to 30. But this is not the actual rationale. His actual rationale was fear that the people would regain their allegiance or reassert their allegiance to Rehoboam if they kept going back down to Jerusalem. They'd get to know him, find out he wasn't such a bad guy after all, and maybe start liking him again and want to be a united country again. That's the real reason. The reason he gives is, it is too much for you to go to Jerusalem. You know, it puts too many miles on your cars and stuff, you know, and we don't want you to have to do that. So here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. And one he placed in Bethel, the other in Dan. And notice what the text then says. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan, which is way up in the north, to worship the one there. I think the narrator is having a little fun with Jeroboam here, saying your excuse really doesn't stand up since you put them in the southern border and way up in the north, and the people were going all the way up there. For many of them, it would have been far shorter just to come on down to Jerusalem. So your reason really doesn't hold. Well, he took bad advice, and this leads ultimately to the division of the worship in the life of the people of Israel. In verse 31, we read about Jeroboam building shrines on the high places. The Hebrew actually says he built a Beit Bamot, a house of high places, and appointed priests from all sorts of people. And I think Ian Provin, in his commentary, which I'll mention in just a minute, points out that there seems to be an intentional contrast between the Beit Yahweh, the house of the Lord, the house of Yahweh, and the house of the high places, which Jeroboam built. He's really establishing an alternative worship, an alternative place, alternative priests, and even alternative festival times. He chooses, it says he instituted a festival, verse 32, on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. This he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made. And at Bethel he also installed priests at the high places he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel. So he instituted the festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. Earlier, I skipped over verse 31 where it talked about his appointing priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. He was simply coming up with his own particular religion here for his own convenience and because of his fear. So we see Rehoboam following bad counsel, leading to the division of the kingdom. Jeroboam now following bad counsel, leading to the division of worship. And then in the next section, which we'll have to take up after the break, we see what good counsel constitutes. What makes for good counsel? And the emphasis in this chapter is on the word of the Lord. Part of the title, I think, I left off, which should be completed, Two Prophets, Jeroboam, and the Importance of Obedience. So that'll be more of the title. But we need to stop now and take a break. And so that we will do, and then we'll come back to this when we return.